It is always a pleasure to be here. I have been here for several times, but I'm sorry this is a very short visit. I'm sort of transiting through Paris from Rio to Pune. So there are other commitments because of which I can't stay longer. What I'm going to talk today about is something which I was very excited about, and I have been working on this program for the last 10 years or so. And we see sort of definitive progress in the last few years, and that is what I want to share with you. Because it is not a specialist audience, I have definitely put equations and stuff like that in the talk, but even if you ignore all those, if you are not the ones who are working in GR or quantum field theory kind of stuff, you will be able to get most of it. So I will explain the things qualitatively. Don't get scared by indices on objects and just ignore them and you will be fine. Okay, so the paradigm which I wanted to concentrate on today is that classical gravity has the same conceptual status as fluid mechanics or elasticity. We know that equations of fluid mechanics and elasticity has been written down much before we knew the atomic structure of matter. Engineers could use it, explain things, demonstrate various physical effects without ever knowing where it came from. What was the atomic structure of matter? I'm going to convince you that classical gravity, Einstein's theory and its generalizations has the same status, and there is some microscopic physics which we can get out of that. This by itself is not a big deal, because if you talk to anyone like a string theorist or loop quantum gravity or any quantum gravity guy, he will say, yeah, of course. I mean, there is a microstructure of space-time and classical gravity is just a long-distance phenomenon. What I'm going to do is something much more definitive. I'm going to show you that there is sufficient amount of internal evidence for this in the structure of classical gravity itself. So what I'm going to present is a completely new way of looking at classical gravity, a new perspective which holds the promise for a better understanding of space-time structure. So this is the part, this is a mathematical part, that looking at classical gravity, staring at it properly, you will be able to, it will tell you if you stare at it carefully that I am an emergent phenomenon. Okay, that is what I wanted to concentrate on. Several people have contributed to this. This is a long list. A few of them are here. And what I'm going to concentrate today mostly on the work done by me and my collaborators. But I have review articles in which other works are cited. So what is the basic point? The conventional view is that you think of gravity as a fundamental interaction, and then you know that a part of gravity is encoded in space-time thermodynamics. Everyone is familiar with the idea that black holes have a temperature and entropy, but it is much more general than that. I mean, there are lots of thermodynamic features which emerges, and people believe that you go from here to here. What I want to tell you is that the right way to look at it is this. You want to change this into this. You want to start from space-time thermodynamics and derive gravity as an emergent phenomenon, and I will show you how it can be done. This is essentially the bottom line is that gravity arises as a thermodynamic limit of some statistical mechanics of unknown atoms of space-time. And the beauty about thermodynamics is that it is a very stable structure. When relativity and quantum theory changed everything which we knew about physics, thermodynamics did not change. You study quantum statistical mechanics, quantum electrodynamics, you never study quantum thermodynamics. There is no such subject. Thermodynamics is already quantum, it is already relativistic. So you use the power of that structure in order to understand what is going on in the microstructure of space-time. So the way, the plan of the talk is this. First, I wanted to still tell you, have a long motivation as to why conventional approach to gravity has several peculiar features. Then I will go on to describe how the concept of horizons and how they interact with quantum theory and the thermodynamics a little bit. I will introduce a concept of entropy density of space-time, maximizing which I will give you a complete alternate paradigm to arrive at classical general relativity. So let me start with the conventional approach to gravity, and let me look at it as a critical appraisal. It is something which people know, but I want to look at it in a very critical view. The first point is that the kinematics of gravity, how does gravity affect matter, how gravity influences matter, is something which can be almost completely determined by principle of equivalence. What it tells you is the following. You think of a geometrical structure, some space-time, and in that space-time light rays are going like this. Light rays are not in straight lines in the presence of gravity, so they go along some arbitrary curved trajectory. These are the null rays. Now you go and look at it in a freely falling frame of an observer. There is a region around this event in which that freely falling frame is valid. And you demand that the special relativistic laws should be valid in that freely falling frame, and that is all you need in order to determine the kinematics of gravity. How gravity affects other matter can come from this. Let me remind you that all the elegance and beauty we associate to Einstein's theory, for example, comes from this. It is this geometric structure, this universality of free fall, this space-time structure. This is where the beauty lies. It is not in the dynamics, it is actually in the kinematics. Even at this level, there are two very peculiar things which happens when you bring gravity in. The first point is that gravity affects every observer's access to information. Because gravity affects light rays, and light rays are the fastest signals you can have regions of space from which signals cannot go to somebody else. The most classic example is black hole, but as I keep emphasizing, it's just a special case of a much more general class of space-times, space-times with horizons. So there can be regions from which you cannot get information. Second is that you are expected to take all observers seriously. There is no special class of observers in general relativity. So an accelerated observer has as much right to do physics as an inertial observer. So this democracy of observer and this access to information getting limited by gravity has some very important consequences. I told you that if you look at event in a freely falling frame, there is laws of special relativity are valid here. But there is no reason to look at it in the freely falling frame. In addition to this freely falling guy, there can be a guy who is sitting quietly here. And this is what we are all doing. We are not freely falling in Earth's gravity. So the trajectory of such a guy will be something like this, and these light rays will form a horizon for him. And this, the technical term for this is a null surface. So any null surface, pieces of the null surface, will be a horizon for certain class of observers, generically called the Rindler observers. These are the uniformly accelerated observers. So they exist in all space-time. So the things like black hole horizons is only a special case of it. Even in the case of black hole horizon, a guy who is falling into the black hole will view the physics very differently from a person who is staying outside. So there is an observer dependence which is coming in here. Okay, all this is about kinematics. I didn't tell you where the space-time comes from. What about the dynamics? When you start looking at it, you find something very disturbing. There is absolutely no elegant principle like the principle of equivalence, which will tell you how to determine the dynamics of gravity. So we'll come back to that. Second, we had already said that the kinematics of gravity tells you gravity is space-time structure. Then why are we thinking of gravity as a field? It is a residue from history. If the history was completely different and Einstein was before Newton or some such thing has happened, which is very difficult to imagine, then we wouldn't have even thought of gravity as a field. We would have just said that it is space-time structure and the space-time structure changes. Just because we had electromagnetic field and gravitational field before relativity came along, we continue to think of it as a field. So in the standard paradigm of field theory, you try to write down an action or a Lagrangian, which is quadratic in the first derivatives of the dynamical variable. This is just half q dot square of the classical mechanics generalized to a field. No such Lagrangian is available in the case of gravity, which maintains the symmetries of the theory. This already should tell you there is something funny going on. This is completely unlike any other real field like Young-Mill fields or electrodynamics, etc. So something peculiar is happening here. But let us ignore it and let us proceed further. So we want to write down some kind of a Lagrangian action and then get the field equation. So the simplest one you will think of is a Lagrangian which depends on the curvature tensor and the metric. Okay? Now the moment you have such a function, the theory is completely determined by this derivative of this with respect to the curvature tensor. This is a new tensor. I will call it the entropy tensor for reasons which will become obvious in a minute. Normally, you never learn it in general relativity. You don't learn it in general relativity because in general relativity, if you do this, this is just a product of Kronecker delta. So there is no point in calling it something. But in a more general class of theories called Lovelock models, it is a non-trivial structure and it is useful to extend your phase space to understand where gravity fits in. We also would like the equations of motion to be second degree, and that puts a constraint on this object that it should be covariantly constant, its derivatives should vanish. Remarkably enough, all such Lagrangians can be classified. You can write down the most general action principle for which the derivative here satisfies this. This is what these two gentlemen do, and that class of theories are called Lankos-Lovelock theories of gravity. In all of them, the field equations are something like a generalization of the Ricci tensor, which is a product of curvature tensor and the entropy tensor. So there are now two tensors here, and in Einstein's theory, this becomes a trivial kind of an object, and this is very similar to Einstein's equations. The matter stress tensor is on the right hand side. In fact, if the dimensions of space-time is 4, this equation reduces to Einstein's theory, and in higher dimensions, it is a more general structure. So this is the way, this is the background in which I would like to work on. Even at this level, after you have introduced the dynamics, there must be some warning bells which will ring in your head. First of all, the variational principle here requires very special provisions, unlike other theories. This is because all these theories contain second derivatives of your dynamical variables, and you need to do something about the surface terms, etc., in order to do that. The action, if you look at the Lagrangian or the action, it has a structure. This is the structure we all love. It is quadratic in the first derivatives of the dynamical variables. But you also get a derivative of some object here, which will involve second derivative of the dynamical variable. So you have a surface term and a bulk term. For example, this is true for everything which I am saying is true for all Lovelock models, unless otherwise specified. But in gravitation, in general relativity, some of you will know that the bulk term is just the gamma square action, and there is an extra surface term. Just the bulk term can give you the field equations. In fact, in general relativity, if you look at the action in the local inertial frame, you will find that it reduces to a pure surface term. So, in fact, the degrees of freedom lives in a surface of that local inertial frame rather than in the bulk, which again is very peculiar. What is most striking is what I would call the holographic duplication of information. I said there is a surface term and a bulk term, and bulk term alone is enough to describe your physics. But when you look at the structure, there is something remarkable happens. It turns out that the surface term is completely determined in terms of the bulk term by this equation. If you think of this as a dynamical variable q, this is like the momentum p, this is like d by dt of pq. Okay, so there is something like this which determines the surface term in terms of the bulk term. So the theory somehow has an interplay between the surface and the bulk, and which is why I called it holographic. And this is all classical general relativity, no quantum theory yet. Okay? And this structure went unnoticed for decades. I mean, very early writings had some hint of it, but it went unnoticed for, and it turns out that it is very important. The most important feature about all these gravitational theories is that all of them are wrong. Okay? Now, usually people say they are incomplete, but that is a very polite way of saying it is wrong. That is because all those almost all these field equations you can write down, certainly in four dimensions, has singularities. And that singularities, the theory breaks down. So the theory has to be embedded in a bigger theory. So the theory cannot be right by itself. So the most natural description would be that at high curvatures, you need some quantum description of the theory. So classical gravity is no good. We need a quantum description of the theory. Unfortunately, we have no model for quantum gravity. After decades of work, we still don't know how to do this. So this motivates me to look at the points of contact and conflict between quantum theory and gravity, with a hope that if you can't come bottom up from quantum theory to classical theory, let us try to go top down and let us see what we know, and let us just go, you know, poking a little bit into regions where they come together and ask what happened. This has been done by several people. And in my opinion, the single most important result from that study is the following. It tells you that if there is an observer who is moving along a trajectory in the space-time such that he has a horizon which limits his region of observation, he will attribute a temperature to that space-time, and the temperature will be essentially decided by an acceleration, either his acceleration or the surface acceleration of that horizon. This is the only place I will bring in H-cross, and I will repeatedly bring in H-cross through this temperature. Okay? Everything else in my talk will be classical. So, this is the only input which you need. So, let me illustrate this. The most famous example again is that of a black hole space-time. So, here is a black hole and somebody is sitting here, and in the proper coordinate system his trajectory will be a hyperbola like this, and this will be the black hole's horizon. He never crosses it and he won't get information from this region at all. Okay? And he will attribute to a black hole a temperature which is proportional to the acceleration. But the same thing happens in an accelerated frame. So, here is the black hole and here is a guy who is going up in an acceleration with an acceleration g, and his trajectory in flat space time happens to be this, and here is a horizon and he won't get information here, and he will attribute a temperature which is proportional to the acceleration of the observer. This is called the Andrew Davis effect. So, why are these horizons hot? I don't want to go into the technicality, but essentially it is because there is a correspondence. In quantum theory, this is the operator which we use to do time evolution. In thermodynamics, this is the partition function structure which we use in canonical ensemble, and this beta sort of corresponds to IT. So, it turns out that whenever there is a periodicity in the imaginary time, there is a temperature associated with the system. Condensed matter physicists know this immediately. Okay? So, this is a very general result, and it turns out that all the space times which has horizons like this has a periodicity in the imaginary time. So, let me just try to illustrate this very briefly. Here is a trajectory and you choose a coordinate system where this is some r is equal to constant and this is some t is equal to constant, then these are the transformation from these x t coordinates to these coordinates, and the metric looks like this. Now, I want to go from the real tau to imaginary values of tau by I tau and real t to imaginary values of t. What happens? Just watch what happens. Cos h becomes cos, sin h becomes sin, and the hyperbola becomes a circle. So, because the hyperbola becomes a circle, this quantity becomes periodic and the imaginary time has a period 2 pi over g. The inverse of that is the temperature. This is what happens. More physically, if you have a freely falling observer in some region and there is an observer sitting here, the vacuum fluctuations as seen by this observer in this region will look like a thermal fluctuations by this observer. So, the same line element or the metric, this guy will write it like a normal special relativistic line element. He will write it with a temperature associated with it. So, space-time has become hot for a particular class of observers. So, this is what I said. So, this temperature is completely independent of field equations. It knows nothing about the dynamics of the space-time. So, you give me a metric, it is periodic in the imaginary time, I can find out its temperature. I don't care where the metric came from, what equations it satisfies. I should also emphasize that this effect is real. If you take a glass of water and run with it with an acceleration, the temperature of the glass, the water will be higher because of the acceleration. Okay, there is nothing mythical about it. Now that we have got temperature, we might ask about other thermodynamic potential. For example, what about entropy? There is a very natural entropy associated with this phenomena called entanglement entropy, but unfortunately it turns out to be useless. It is useless for two reasons. First of all, it is always proportional to area. Entropies are proportional to area in Einstein's theory, but as we will see, it is not a general phenomena. In general, entropies are not proportional to the area of the horizon. Second and more important, it is divergent. So, until you give me a cutoff which somebody else has to tell you what the correct value is, you will not be able to predict anything. So, the question is why? Why is it that an observer who is here can associate a nice temperature to this, but he can't associate associate entropy? This is because all thermodynamics at this stage is becoming temperature dependent, observer dependent. By all thermodynamics, I mean the normal thermodynamics which you and I know in steam engines, for example, is observer dependent. The proof is very, you can give a technical proof, the qualitative proof is this. The temperature of the vacuum itself is observer dependent. A glass of water for a particle physicist is a highly excited state of the vacuum, and then if you compute its temperature, you will find that two observers will attribute different temperature to that. This means that we need a paradigm shift in the way we think about these things, and this is very important. We are very, very accustomed to thinking of degrees of freedom as an observer independent quantity, but they become observer dependent because degrees of freedom are closely related to entropy, and the entropy associated with a system depends on which observer you are talking to, and that becomes observer dependent. So, for example, if you ask the question, what are the degrees of freedom because of which black hole has an entropy? This is a very often asked question, and unfortunately it is even answered once in a while, but you cannot have an answer to that question without specifying which observer you are talking about, because a guy who is freely falling into the black hole will attribute very different thermodynamics to it compared to a guy who is outside, and that need to be convolved into that. So, what actually happens in these cases is mathematically described in one of these papers, that certain degrees of freedom, which are like gauge degrees of freedom, gets upgraded into true physical degrees of freedom for a particular class of observer. A different class of observer will say, oh, they are gauge degrees of freedom, you don't associate entropy with it. And so there is a rigorous mathematical formalism behind what I am describing to you in qualitative English. In fact, you can work this out in a very specific, well-defined case. You take a box of normal ideal gas and you accelerate it. Then you find a very interesting mix between the normal temperature you associate with it and the temperature which comes from the acceleration. For example, when it is very close to the event horizon of a black hole or very close to the Rindler horizon, the entropy starts scaling as the area, not as the volume. So these things can be demonstrated. Okay. Fine. Now let us go a bit further and ask, what is the entropy of a horizon? So this is going to be a little technical, but the bottom line is easy. All these theories are coordinate transformation invariant. So if I take a coordinate and I shift it by a vector field, the theory is still invariant. And this invariance leads to a conservation law of something called the Noether current. Okay? So this is a quantity which can be determined in terms of this PABCD. It turns out, you can prove this rigorously, it was done by Bob Wald, that the entropy of a horizon is essentially an integral of this entropy tensor with some normals of the horizon, etc. It's called binormal. But just concentrate on this. If I know this tensor, I know the entropy, and if I know the entropy, I know this tensor. But remember that the dynamics is completely determined by this. So if I know the entropy, I know the dynamics. This is exactly what happens in thermodynamics. If you tell me the temperature, it doesn't fix the dynamics. I can have a glass of water at some temperature, I can have a metallic rod at the same temperature. But if you tell me the entropy as a function of energy and volume, for example, or some other thermodynamic potential, for a glass of water, it will be different from a metallic rod, and that fixes the dynamics. So this is what is encoded in the dynamics. However, the relation between something like a coordinate transformation, which is a purely geometric idea, and a conserved current from this, and a relation to entropy, is a complete mystery in the conventional way of looking at things. The question is why. So, before I do that, I also wanted to tell you there is another way of calculating the entropy. I told you that the gravitational action can be separated into a bulk term and a surface term. You can just take the bulk term and vary it, either ignore the surface term or you sort of cancel it with some other counter term, something called Gibbons-Hawking counter term, etc. And you can vary the bulk term to get the field equations. So the field equations know nothing about the surface term, you have cancelled it out. Once you have got the field equation, suppose you have a solution with a horizon, you just for fun you go and evaluate the surface term on a horizon and you find that it gives you the entropy. So the question is, how does the surface term which you have ignored all along know the physics which is determined by the bulk term? The answer has to do with that holographic duplication of information which I told you earlier, that the bulk and surface talk to each other through that. In fact, you can take this further. When you look at, these are the internal evidences which tells you that gravity probably is thermodynamics. If you go and look at this in any of the Lovelock models, you evaluate this action, the bulk term and the surface term in the Euclidean sector, it turns out that it is actually the free energy of the space-time. the surface term acts as the entropy and the bulk term acts as the energy. And this is also related to that Noether current which I told you, it can be and the holographic relationship between these two will be preserved. So, when you are obtaining the field equations by varying these things, you thought you are varying an action, but you are actually varying the free energy of the space time. So, let me try to give you a simple analogy about what is happening here, which makes it more mysterious. So, here is a comparison between a space time with a horizon. Think of it as a black hole with a horizon. Now, you think of two different black holes where the horizon could be here or here at two displaced positions, the radius of the horizon can be different. So, here is another familiar analogy. There is a gas with a gas of molecules with a piston, and the piston can be at two different places. Okay? Now, we know that in this particular case, if I look at two different volumes for this, there is an equation TdS equal dE plus pdV which satisfies this. The question is what happens here? I am saying that gravity is thermodynamic, so what happens here? Well, you can write down the equation satisfied by this system in Einstein's theory, for example, on the horizon. This is the equation. This kappa is the surface gravity here. P is the pressure due to external sources. If it is there are no pressure in the external source, that P is 0. And this is a textbook result. You look at any general relativity textbook, you can write it like this. This does not look thermodynamical at all. Just multiply it by dA, the small decrement in this area. The 4 pi P A square dA becomes P into dV. This quantity on the first, you can put a h cross on numerator and h cross on denominator by hand. And read this off as the temperature, which I told you. As I told you, the only place I will bring in h cross is through this temperature. Then the remaining thing has to be ds and d. So, you can immediately read off the entropy and the energy of the system. Einstein's equations reduces to Tds equal dE plus pdV on the surface of any horizon. Well, that looks interesting, but maybe it is a special feature of Einstein's theory in statics, spherically symmetric, black hole space time. So, is it really a big deal? Yes, it is a big deal. After this work was done, people looked at a whole lot of examples. This is a sort of a small sample of this. For very many different kind of theories like three-dimensional BTZ, Lankos-Lovelock theories with static horizon, dynamical horizons, even Horowitz-Lipschitz gravity. In all these cases, you can prove that the field equations reduce to Tds equal dE plus pdV on the horizon. So, if field equations of a gravitational theories reduce to a thermodynamic identity on any horizon in a very wide class of theory, I find that sufficiently convincing reason to believe that we are looking at gravity the wrong way around. Okay? It should be thought of as a thermodynamic limit. This is the first example. Now, let me give you one more example. This is of some importance in this region because it was first done by Damour. Damour and following him various other people like Kip Thorne and Price etc. showed that in the case of black holes, the black hole horizon can be thought of as a dissipative membrane with some thermal conductivity, bulk viscosity, shear viscosity etc. and the Einstein's equations can be reduced to Navier-Stokes equation for this. Very recently, I could generalize this result to a much wider class. The statement of the theorem is the following. You take Einstein's equation and project it to any null surface in any space-time. No black holes, no horizons, etc. Any null surfaces or horizons for some observers. And look at it in the freely falling frame and it becomes a Navier-Stokes equation. So, this is the second example. First, I told you that in equilibrium conditions, the Einstein's field equations or any gravitational theory's field equation reduced to a thermodynamic identity. Now, I am telling you that even in time dependent cases, if you project the equations onto a null surface, it becomes Navier-Stokes equation, exactly Navier-Stokes equations. So, Navier-Stokes equations has underlying degrees of freedom from which the fluid theory comes up, and this is remarkable. This strongly suggests emergent behavior, and there has been quite a bit of work from string theory motivated things getting similar results. It is technically somewhat different from that, but it is very closely related to it. So, the question is why does this happen? My answer is that gravity is the thermodynamic limit of the statistical mechanics of some degrees of freedom. Okay, so that is the approach which we should take. So if that is the case, then let us go and ask how historically the statistical mechanical ideas developed, and maybe we can get some lessons out of it. So historically, Boltzmann is the one who started it all, and what he said is very simple. He said, if you can heat something, it must have microstructure, okay, and you can heat up gas. If you read the history at that time, it is very fascinating. Everybody knew that there is something like heat. Even caveman knew that hot substances, you better not touch it. But nobody knew at that time what exactly is heat, and people had to make all kinds of postulates like some calorific fluid which is going from place to place, etc., etc., etc. Boltzmann cut through all this nonsense at one stroke. He said there is no such thing as heat. There are microscopic degrees of freedom. What you thought was a fluid or a gas is not a continuum, it is discrete, and these discrete degrees of freedom has normal mechanistic energy, and that is what you call thermal energy. What is more important, he gave you something very quantitative. He said that, this is the way to interpret this properly in our context, he said that if you want to store an amount of energy delta E in some material at a temperature T, you need this many microscopic degrees of freedom. This is a very nice equation when written like this. Just think about it. Delta E is a purely thermodynamic variable. Temperature is a purely thermodynamic variable. So the right hand side is purely thermodynamic. Left hand side has absolutely no interpretation in thermodynamics. It is a statistical mechanics quantity. In thermodynamic limit, it goes to infinity. So if you know the thermodynamics, you can determine at least something about the statistical mechanics. If you take a gas in a small volume dV, there will be certain number density of degrees of freedom. You attribute half kT to each one of them, and this integral will give you the total energy. So it demands granularity with a finite n, and the degrees of freedom scales as the volume of the system. Very good. So can we do this for space-time? Well, you can heat up the space-time. And Boltzmann tells us that if you can heat up something, it should have microscopic degrees of freedom. So how many microscopic degrees of freedom do I have in space-time? So we should probably study gas dynamics. We should study space-time the way we studied gas dynamics before we knew about the microscopic structure. So can I determine the equivalent of Avogadro number for space-time? Can I determine an equation like this where the delta E and delta T and read off this delta N, even without knowing what it is? Which is what people did before atomic theory of matter came. Remarkably enough, this can be done. It turns out that you can write the standard field equations in gravity in this form, E is equal to half kT times a dN, and this dN now scales not as the volume but as the area. It is holographic. The degrees of freedom scale as the area of the bounding volume. And it is again determined by the entropy tensor, which is what you would have expected because the degrees of freedom should contribute to entropy. So the actual result will be like you take the Andrew Davis temperature and multiply by dN, and dN is dN by dA times dA, dN by dA is this quantity. In Einstein's theory, it is very simple, so let me concentrate on that. It tells you that there is this fundamental constant Planck length square, which is a unit of area. Every unit of area contributes 1 bit of degrees of freedom. So 1 square centimeter will have 10 to the 66 degrees of freedom, and you multiply it by the acceleration temperature and you integrate, this gives you the energy in GR. This equation is an exact result in GR. So this is so beautiful that I couldn't resist the temptation of giving you a simple derivation of that. Okay? This derivation requires only BSc level, Bachelor's of Science level physics. It is not completely rigorous, but it captures the essence. You can do this completely in Newtonian theory. So you take a Newtonian gravitational system, here is some source of gravity, and this is an equipotential surface, and there are observers sitting here. And there are also observers who are freely falling there with some g. Now you ask, suppose I did try to do what I have just now said. Take half kT energy, and take a small element of area here dA and divide it by Planck length square, and you integrate this quantity over the entire surface. Calculate this energy. What is it? Now, this temperature has a H cross in it, this Planck length has a H cross, they cancel out right at the next step. And you find that you essentially get n dot g, and because it is an equipotential surface, this surface integral can be converted into a volume integral. Then you use your standard result and you get E equals mc square. In fact, you can reverse the entire argument. You start with E equals mc square, write it as rho dV, use Newton's laws to convert rho to divergence of g upon 4 pi g, convert this integral by Gauss law into a surface integral. Only place where you have to bring in the h cross is at this stage, you want a temperature, so you put a h cross in numerator and denominator and you get this. This is half k t times degrees of freedom, E equals half n k t or E equals mc square, they are equivalent. So, even at the Newtonian level, this entire analogy carries through, and there is an equipartition law which holds in this particular case. Anyone could have done this, it does not, you would just need to know that this is the expression for temperature in terms of an acceleration, there is nothing else in that. So, this is a remarkable result, and the reason it works is because the combination TdS does not care about the granularity. This is true even in thermodynamics, it is not emphasized that way. TdS has no Boltzmann's constant in it. Entropy scales as the Boltzmann's constant, temperature for a given energy state scale as 1 by Boltzmann's constant, TdS is independent of Boltzmann's constant. TdS is independent of statistical mechanics, it is thermodynamic. Similarly, here the T will scale as H cross, the entropy will scale as 1 by H cross, so TdS is independent of H cross, it is classical, it does not care about the quantum microstructure of the space time. So, given this, you can ask some other questions, like what about given the equilibrium condition, can you count the fluctuations around the equilibrium? I do not want to go into this in great detail, but I just want to mention this. It turns out that if you calculate by the same method as Einstein taught us, if you know the equilibrium thermodynamics, you can study fluctuations around equilibrium. And you can calculate how much those fluctuations contribute to the energy density. And if you do this for the whole universe, you get a result that it is exactly the amount of energy density which we attribute to the dark energy. This is very tantalizing. It is a geometric mean between an ultraviolet and infrared cutoff. Unfortunately, so this tells you that maybe dark energy has something to do with the fluctuations of the microscopic degrees of freedom, and that is what we are seeing. It is a relic from the Kondon gravity. Unfortunately, it is very difficult to make an estimate for this, so I will skip this. Essentially to say that there is a core of an idea here, but we have not been able to make it so precise so that you can estimate the actual value of the cosmological constant today. You have to get a number like exponential root 2 times pi to the power 4 or something like that. A purely dimensionless quantities has to give you that number 10 to the power 60, but there is hope for that. Okay, so let me summarize this part of the talk. What have we done? We have compared a macroscopic body with space-time. You start with the question, can the system be hot? Yes, macroscopic bodies can be hot and space-time can be hot. Can it transfer heat? Yes, it can transfer heat. You can heat up a water with gas, or if you take water at rest in an accelerated frame, will get heated up. How is it that a body can store heat energy? We did not know the answer before Boltzmann, and Boltzmann said that if you can heat it up, it must have microscopic degrees of freedom. Same answer here, space-time must have microscopic degrees of freedom. But can you determine the microscopic degrees of freedom? How many degrees of freedom do you need in order to store an energy dE at temperature T? Equipartition law, here also equipartition law. Can you read off this dN? Yes, here you can do that in thermal equilibrium, depends on the body. And here also you can do it when static field equations hold and depends on the theory of gravity, which theory of gravity you are using, Einstein's theory or some generalizations. This dN also tells you what the entropy is, and does it agree with other ways of determining entropy by second law and things like that? Yes, it agrees here, it also agrees here. So, everything about this assumes classical gravity and tells you that when you rewrite it, it has a complete thermodynamic interpretation. I hope I have convinced you of that. But at this stage, we should make a leap. If that is the case, then there must be a complete alternate way of looking at the thing. How do we do in normal macroscopic body? In normal macroscopic body, you do not wait to write down the full quantum mechanical Hamiltonian and get its limit. You just say that give me a thermodynamic potential depending on the context, entropy, free energy, enthalpy, whatever you have, and you extremize it and you get your dynamics. So you should be able to do the same thing in gravity. You don't need all these metric and varying the metric and an action and thinking of gravity as a field and all these sort of things. You should have a completely thermodynamic way of getting Einstein's equation. I want to show you how to do that. So what you want to do is to have a thermodynamic potential in terms of some degrees of freedom, and you want to extremize it for all class of, for a class of observers who attribute this thermodynamics to get the field equations. So what is the, so let us go through it a bit slowly. First of all, you have these thermodynamic potentials, any one of them, entropy, free energy, whatever. And even in standard thermodynamics, they are a connecting link between the fundamental and emergent descriptions. The fundamental description is in terms of microscopic molecules and the Hamiltonian for the molecules, and the emergent description is completely thermodynamic, and these potentials connect that. Now, the nature of these variables as well as the this potential in thermodynamics depends on the material bodies. Here it will depend on the class of observers you are talking to. Some observer will attribute an entropy, some observer will not. So it depends, there is a new level of observer dependence in the theory. So we need a thermodynamical principle, and we want to extremize it for all class of observers in order to give the field equation. So let me try to orient you as to how to do this before throwing in the mathematics. The idea is something like this. Very long back, this is what started the entire black hole thermodynamics. John Wheeler asked his graduate student Bekenstein that if I have a black hole horizon and a hot cup of tea, and I chuck this hot cup of tea across the horizon, then I reduce the entropy accessible to the outside observers, and that looks bad. So Bekenstein came back with the answer that when you do that, there is a entropy associated with the horizon which goes up, which should be proportional to the area, and then everything will be fine. But we can do something slightly different. You don't have to chuck cups of tea into the horizon. Instead, you can think of a virtual displacement of the horizon normal to it itself, and that can just take care of engulfing this T. So you want to associate the thermodynamic potentials with these null vectors, which are normals to the horizons. This is exactly what you do in theory of elasticity, if you have studied that. It's unfortunate that we don't teach the modern day children theory of elasticity at all, I mean, at least not in India. But it is a fascinating subject, and the way it is done is that the beginning would be just you take a solid and you are distorting that solid. When you distort the solid, this point x goes to some x bar, so there is a displacement vector. All that you do is to get this displacement vector and associate thermodynamic potentials which are quadratic in the derivatives of these displacement vectors. So you can do the same thing. You start with a null surface, and when you do space-time diffeomorphism, most of the time nothing happens. But if you start tinkering with the null surface, you are affecting the information content. Information is related to entropy. So these kind of displacement, distorting this null surface into something like this, should cost you some entropy. So what you want to do is to associate a thermodynamic potential with it, which is quadratic in this form. So you can do that. So you write down a potential like this, and you can keep arbitrary tensors here, but eventually it will turn out that this is the entropy tensor of the theory and this is the matter stress tensor. So I have used the same variables. You write it down and you say that you are going to extremize this entropy density for all null vectors, all observers simultaneously. And that should lead to your second order field equation. It turns out that you can uniquely fix this to be the entropy tensor of a Lovelock model, and this as the stress tensor. And now there is a nice interpretation to these conditions. These conditions are the covariant conservation of these two quantities. It essentially tells you these are the elastic constants of space-time, and they are constants in the sense that their covariant derivatives vanish. So you write this down and you extremize this for all null vectors, and you get the field equations of the Lovelock theory, except for one arbitrary integration constant, which is the cosmological constant, which cannot be determined by that. What is more important, in some sense, is that after you have done this extremization and you have got the field equations, you can go and calculate the extremum value of this functional. You maximize the function to find where the function is maximum, and then you can calculate the value of the function at that point. That gives you back the entropy of the horizons in the theory. This is a very non-trivial consistency check. The formalism was not designed to reproduce it, and it is an act, it's not an accident, but it is an important consistency check which it passes. If you are working in d is equal to 4 or at the lowest order, this gives you exactly general relativity except for a cosmological constant. The equation becomes, this is equal to 0 would have been Einstein's equation. Now it tells you that it projected to null vectors is equal to 0. The important new feature here is that this has a new symmetry. If I take this energy momentum tensor and I add to it a constant times GAB, the GAB gets annihilated by on a null vector. So, the shifting the 0 point energy of the matter fields is ignored by gravity. Gravity does not couple to bulk vacuum energy anymore. This has always been thought of as a major problem, that gravity feels the 0 point of the energy and you can shift it around. You can, when you look at it from a thermodynamic perspective. Thermodynamic perspective, classical gravity does not couple to the gravity. So, if the cosmological constant has been 0, this would have given you the most elegant explanation for it. I should have done it 25 years back. Unfortunately, we now know that cosmological constant probably is not 0, and that comes because this symmetry is a classical symmetry, and it is well known in many particle physics examples that quantum corrections break the classical symmetries. And it is that breaking which leads to a very tiny coupling between the gravity and the vacuum energy, and that is what we see as dark energy. So, let me try to summarize what I have said in the form of a diagram and in the form of a text. I am almost at the end of my talk. Okay. So, you start with principle of equivalence, and the principle of equivalence gives you three important points. This is standard stuff. First, it tells you that gravity is geometry. The kinematics of gravity can be determined entirely in terms of space-time geometry. It tells you that the light cone structure is affected by gravity. Because light cone structure is affected by gravity, there is going to be causal communication between events are going to be determined by gravity. And it also tells you that you can use any coordinate system and any observer. There is democracy of observers. Now, the fact that light cone structure is affected by gravity immediately tells you that there are observers who will have horizons, who will only see part of the space-time. They can't access the rest of the space-time. And the fact that all observers are equivalent tells you that to every horizon you have to associate an entropy. Now, the democracy of observers also tells you that the theory is invariant under distortions of the space-time solid, so to speak. You go around pushing and pulling the space-time solid in this form, and that leads to a conserved current. This conserved current, which is related to the entropy because this affects the information content, tells you that the space-time has an entropy density coming from the microscopic degrees of freedom. We don't know what the microscopic degrees of freedom. We are doing space-time physics exactly the way physicists were attacking gas dynamics before we knew the atomic structure of matter, from top down. So, the space-time should have some entropy density, and this entropy we can take the clue from standard thermodynamics and say that it should be maximal for all horizons. Lo and behold, that leads to the field equations of the theory. So, this is a completely new way of looking at the field equations of theory. You start with this thermodynamic structure, and then you bring in the fact that gravity is geometry and the entropy maximization gives you the field equation. This is a very general principle and it can be done for a very wide class of theories. Now, you need to know what is the form of this entropy density, and the most natural choice is entropy is quadratic in the derivatives of the null vectors. If you assume that, you get the Lovelock field equations, and in d is equal to 4, you uniquely reproduce Einstein's field equation. This also tells you that there is an equipartition of energy, and I can actually count the number of degrees of freedom in space-time, even though I do not know what it is. It is exactly the way people could determine the Avogadro number of a gas, even before they knew what molecules are or what atomic system are. And that can be done from top down, because of thanks to this equipartition law. What the microstructure of space-time, string theory or whatever, has to do eventually is to connect up from bottom up. Why is there this equipartition? why is there this entropy density? It should be able to give expressions for this, and it should sort of try to explain why entropy is quadratic in this. That would be the challenge when you are coming from bottom up in this approach. So, if you have sort of followed through the basic logic, the main point is that this entire paradigm, this new way of looking at gravity, gives answers to a series of questions which you can ask in classical gravity. Suppose you just take classical gravity as it has been taught to you, then you can ask this question: why is it that a current related to a geometry has anything to do with a thermodynamic variable like entropy? You don't have an answer in the conventional perspective, I can offer you an answer in this perspective. Similarly, for all other questions, how come Einstein's equation reduced to a TdS equal dE plus PdV on a horizon? Why should it do that? How is it that it reduces to a Navier-Stokes equation in all null surfaces? In a conventional approach to gravity, you have to take all these as some algebraic accidents. Oh, it is like that, but there is no deeper reason to it. I find this unsatisfactory. Similarly, if you look at Einstein-Hilbert action, it has very peculiar features. The action gives you the surface term, gives you the horizon entropy, and the microscopic degrees of freedom obey a thermodynamic equipartition law. And I can give you a completely different thermodynamic variational principle, where I have not varied the metric. I have not treated metric as a dynamical variable at all, and I get back a background consistency condition on that metric. And it works for a very wide class of theories. Why does all this happen? So, my claim would be that these are the internal evidence hidden in conventional gravitational theories, which is telling you that we are looking at it the wrong way around. Gravity is thermodynamics of space-time, and then that is the approach you should take in order to approach this. So, there is sufficient internal evidence to conclude that the dynamics of gravity is like fluid mechanics or elasticity. This deep connection between gravity and thermodynamics goes well beyond Einstein's theory. That is why I wanted to talk about Lovelock theories. So, finally, it may turn out that Einstein's theory is the correct theory and d is equal to 4 is the correct dimensions of the space-time. I have no quarrels with it. But it is nice to expand the phase space, look at a wider class of structures to understand that there is nothing special about Einstein's theory. This happens in a very general case. And the deformations of the space-time medium, when you are pushing and pulling the space-time, by and large it doesn't do anything. But because you are distorting the null surfaces, you affect the information content, and the extremizing that entropy gives you the field equations. So, at that level, the null surfaces and the null vectors provide a very effective collective degree of freedom of the unknown microscopic physics. It is like density or velocity of a fluid. They have no meaning at the microscopic level, at the atomic level. But at a collective level, in a coarse-grained way, it has some meaning. And that is the correct approach here also. And the gravity is holographic in many ways. So, what are the open question and challenges for the future? In my mind, you need to understand what precisely is emergent here. I mean, people use this word emergent gravity. I mean, there are a lot of people working in this and they all have different ideas on that. I have tried to be very, very precise what I mean by that. I have a metric, I have a space-time, it is only the field equations which I think of it as emergent. But maybe you should do better. You should think of even space-time, metric, everything to emerge. I don't know how to do that. And there must be some pre-geometric structure in that. That's a good question to ask. The second thing which is unsatisfactory is the matter sector. Gravity looks so beautiful and it is so nicely thermodynamic. Everything fits in very well. It's exactly the story with Einstein's theory. Gravity was beautifully geometric, but the matter has to be put in by hand. And that was always ugly and it continues to remain ugly. So, there must be some way of getting the matter out of geometry in some form. And I had already told you that a very new level of observer dependence comes in here in thermodynamics. In some sense, the all progress of physics is linked to we realizing that something which we thought was observer independent is actually observer dependent. Okay. This happened in relativity, this happened in quantum theory, and I think the next paradigm shift is making thermodynamics observer dependent. It has a lot of broader implications which I am not going into, but it is worth studying. It is also very important that you produce a falsifiable prediction. We had to do better than other models of quantum gravity. Now, the best hope for that is in cosmology. the accelerated expansion of the universe is probably a residue of this fluctuations of the underlying degrees of freedom. It is possible that if the null cones are fluctuating and you are looking at light coming from a distant quasar to you, there will be some fuzziness which possibly can be detected. There are ideas like holographic noise, which space interferometric experiments can detect. So there are ways in which this can be done, and it is important that you make a falsifiable prediction. So that is the end of it, and if you want to read more about it, there are two articles here. The first one is very conceptual and it is similar to the talk I gave today. This one is more technical and has all the algebra. It's a detailed review article. So these are some of the people who were associated in this work. All these people are either ex or current students of mine. These three are current students, others are past students and postdocs. One person whom I have been discussing this extensively, a slightly unlikely person in because he doesn't do quantum gravity, is Donald Lindenbell, and he has been very influential on the way I was thinking about these things. Thank you for your time.